Committee to order. The time is 1:03 p.m. Members present at this time, Representative Chris Birch, Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Dave Tallarico, Representative George Rauscher, Representative Harriet Drummond, Vice Chair Representative John Lincoln, Co-Chair Representative Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Karen Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is Recording Secretary Butch Carver and our LIO moderator Leah Kraft. So thank you to both of you for your help today. If we could please ask folks to silence their cell phones as we get started.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. I just had kind of a scheduling. I'm looking through the next coming week, and I believe it's House Bill 331, the oil tax credit repayment. Mm-hmm. Does that show up here, or will that eventually show up here?
If we schedule it, it will be on the schedule.
Okay, but it's...
So it's not scheduled at this time.
But it's in the hopper somewhere?
Yeah, it's been referred.
Mm-hmm. It's referred. Okay, gotcha. Okay, I didn't know how timely that was or whether that was popping up or whatever, so...
Well, we'll see.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, so today's schedule is House Bill 27, High-Risk Chemicals for Children's Exposure, House Bill 355, hopefully completing our work on that with additional work on the amendments, and so hopefully Representative Rauscher will be back. He's going to testify on another bill at this time, and then we'll have the first bill for House Bill 330, the DNR Disclosure of Confidential Info. So the first order of business will be House Bill 27, High-Risk Chemicals for Child Exposure. And before we go into the presentation, we'll entertain a motion to adopt the CS.
Yes. Madam Co-Chair, I move that the committee adopt the CS for HB 27. It's 30-LS0264/D as the working document.
And then I'll object for purposes of explanation, and I'm going to hand off the gavel here for a moment to Representative Josephson and then go put myself in the testifier seat.
Representative Tarr, just
thank
put your
you.
Name on the record. And
yes, Mr. Chairman. Representative Garen Tarr from Anchorage, and pleased to be able to present House Bill 27 to you. As you can see with the low bill number, this is a bill that was introduced quite a while ago, so we're really looking forward to today and having the opportunity to present this bill before you. You notice the title, Toxic Free Children's Act. This is a bill that's addressing some of the chemicals used in our environment. And to begin the conversation about this, I think it's important to put it in the context of how chemicals in our environment are regulated. And I want to specifically point to the federal laws and talk about some of the weaknesses in these federal laws. The first two listed here, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, you notice was passed in 1910. The second, the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, passed in 1938. So these major pieces of legislation, you can see, are quite old, and so there are some problems with the way these chemicals have been regulated in our environment. The third one listed there, the Toxic Substances Control Act, was passed in 1976, and this one was just recently updated. We're going to talk a little bit more about that one. But just want to sort of keep in mind and what is important to talk about in the context of these bills is just sort of what else was going on during that time. So in between when those first pieces of legislation were passed and then when we get to 1976, we had some pretty substantial events. For example, folks might remember when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire on June 22nd in 1969. There used to be a saying, the solution to pollution is dilution. So frequently during that time, you know, chemicals were just put into the water, put into the air. People might have that image of a sewage pipe that just went directly into a water body. That was pretty typical way of handling our waste. Also during this time, between sort of the 1910, 1938, and then we get to 1976, we had the invention of a lot of these chemicals. A lot of the chemicals that are used today were actually developed during World War II. They started out as being chemicals that were developed to be used for warfare. And then following the end of the war, they were repurposed. These are the organophosphates and organochlorines for different chemical use in our everyday life, from pesticides used in food production to chemicals we use in personal care products. So you had this whole sort of chemical revolution, a lot of chemicals being used in the products that we use every day. But at the same time, you know, little understanding, little oversight, or little testing of the chemicals that were being used, which brings you into, you know, the third bullet point there, the Toxic Control Substance Act, and that's happening right around the same time. And I think that's why you have to sort of think of this historically, what was going on when you had the Cuyahoga River spontaneously catch on fire because it was so polluted. What happened following that is the beginnings of the Ohio EPA, which actually predated the national EPA that was founded in 1970. And so, you know, all around that time, you know, we have this huge introduction and transition and use of chemicals in our everyday life, but very little regulation and oversight that leads you to the Toxic Substances Control Act that gets passed in 1976. A major landmark improvement in terms of chemical safety was the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2008. What was unique and important about this was it started to use children as the benchmark for safety. Previously, and this is something folks might be familiar with in terms of the medical interventions that people have and the kind of medical therapies we have, it used to be that those things were just tested on sort of an average white male. And we didn't do a good job of looking at impacts to females, and we definitely didn't look at what was happening with children. And in the meantime, what we learned through a lot of scientific research is that children are much more vulnerable to the exposure to chemicals in our environment. They have the hand-to-mouth thing where they're touching everything and putting it in their mouth. They also have higher metabolism relative to adults, so they're metabolizing things much more quickly, and they're still developing. Their reproductive health systems aren't developed. Their brains aren't fully developed. So any exposure to these chemicals is much more impactful while in the developing fetus stage or as a young person in infancy and growing up. And to keep, you know, remind us why we're still working on this, and this is just, you know, a quote that I pulled today in terms of the status. It's the Consumer Product Safety Commission has and is continuing to implement regulations based on this law that was passed a decade ago. So there's a huge lag in what's happening around regulations of these chemicals in our environment and what we're and so we're being exposed to a lot of things that may or may not be safe. And I just want to mention regarding the Toxic Control Substances Act, when that law was passed, every chemical that was in use at that time was grandfathered in. There hadn't been testing about the long-term health effects, and there hadn't been testing about the long-term environmental impacts. But when we passed this law, we just grandfathered them in, and that was about 60,000 different chemicals. So just like that, 60,000 chemicals were allowed to be for use. And that number is closer to 85,000 today in terms of the chemicals that are used in food, the chemicals used in our foods, the chemicals used in our personal care products, the chemicals used in furniture and other things, and we'll be talking about that today. And so when we look at this slide, this is sort of an update and gives a comparison of the pre-reform TSCA and the post-reform TSCA as amended under the Frank Lautenberg Chemical Safety for the 21st Century Act. And some things are pretty significant about this. If you look on the left-hand column, mandatory duty on EPA to evaluate existing chemicals with clear and enforceable deadlines. Pre-reform, no duty to review, no deadlines for action. And that's why things have been in use in our environment for decades and decades without being fully assessed for the long-term health and environmental impacts. For example, TSCA pre-reform was such a weak piece of legislation that asbestos, which is a known carcinogen, could not be banned under that law. So it's a very weak law. When you look at the left-hand side, chemicals assessed against a risk-based safety standard versus a risk-benefit balancing standard, huge, huge change in the way that we're evaluating these in the regulatory context. The risk-benefit award used to look at something and say, well, a 1 in 100,000 people might be impacted by this, and that's an acceptable risk relative to the potential economic benefit. Well, you might be that one person in 100,000 that gets cancer, and I didn't ever want to be the one person in 100,000, so I never found that to be a fully satisfactory regulatory regime. If you could contrast that to the left-hand side, chemicals assessed against a risk-based safety standard, that's definitely improvement, but what a lot of folks really wanted was to move to what's called the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle suggests that we don't introduce chemicals into our environment until we know for sure that there are no adverse health human health effects or long-term environmental impacts. A couple of the other distinctions there, too. important, and the last bullet there, expanded authority to more quickly require development of chemical information when needed versus pre the testing on existing chemicals required lengthy rulemaking. And that, again, is why this law was so weak in terms of being able to really respond to new safety information. So the point is that much remains to be done and much remains to be learned. And when we talk about these things, people often want to talk in absolutes, and that's a real challenge, and there's several reasons for that. There's a difference between causation and correlation. And in a policy context, a lot of times people are looking for an exact causation relationship. Exposure to chemical A leads to health problem, you know, associated with that. Well, there's some real challenges to that paradigm because we don't test on humans, and we're not going to change that. We're not going to knowingly expose humans to potentially harmful chemicals for the purposes of science. We don't do that. We do lab studies on lower organisms, but we don't test on humans, and so sometimes it takes us a little bit longer to learn about what the human health impacts are for humans. We're certainly never going to test on developing fetuses, and so much of what we are learning about this is from testing that's been done more recently, you know, taking the blood and breast milk samples to learn about what developing fetuses are being exposed to in utero and then what infants are being exposed to through the breast milk. We just completed the Human Genome Project in 2003. The Human Genome Project was a significant breakthrough in understanding for human health because basically it becomes the reference library for human health conditions. And as we try to understand the relationships between the exposure to these chemicals and our genetics, we need that reference library to be able to match things up. And so, for example, if you think about the conversation around breast cancer, we can now say that we know some breast cancers link to environmental exposures, and we know that some breast cancers link to genetic markers. And that Human Genome Project and that information is what's allowed us to do that. But keep in mind that it's just a few years ago that work was completed. So when we're talking about regulation of these chemicals, we're talking about human health, what we really need to understand is that we know things today, and we can act on those. But we are learning new things every single day, and a lot of research is being done in this area. And what's been really significant about the most recent research is understanding that even very low-level exposures can have adverse health effects, very low-level exposures. And so we're all being exposed to these on a daily basis. But why the health impacts are so varied is that we all have different genetics, we all have different lifestyles, we eat different foods, we exercise in different ways, and so our exposure isn't consistent. When we look to more isolated populations of individuals, for example, farm workers in the Central Valley of California exposed to high level of pesticides, we can more clearly develop these causation relationships between the chemicals they're exposed to and the adverse health effects. So I just want to get that context out there that sometimes people have this idea that these chemicals are regulated by the federal government, that something wouldn't be on the market if it wasn't safe, but we really need to just understand that is not the case. That is not the case. That things are regulated today in a way where they're learning every day and they're using, you know, science that they have, but so much more needs to be done and so much more needs to be learned. The reason we're so concerned about these chemicals is this is just a list of some of the health problems that we can link to exposure. We're going to talk about cancer today relative to the PBDEs, the flame retardants, and the how that's a leading cause of cancer for firefighters exposed to those chemicals. We're going to talk about endocrine disruptors, that's our hormone system, and how that's impacted. Birth defects, reproductive health disorders, developmental delays, the list goes on and on. There are reasons that we should be very concerned about the chemicals that we're being exposed to in our environment. There are three main ways that individuals are exposed to these chemicals: absorption, inhalation, and eating. And just some examples there, absorption, of course, like a personal care product. That's why we care about the things that are put into the lotions we use and the shampoos and the fragrances. Those are the things that are directly absorbed into our skin. The inhalation, the flame retardants, we're going to talk about that today. They're found in the dust of the home products that we have in our homes, and then also inhaled. And this would be what's causing the problem and the cancer for firefighters when those products burn. And then, of course, through eating, and this would be things like pesticides on fruits and vegetables and milk and meat. The class of chemicals we're going to focus in on today are the flame retardants, the PBDEs, polybrominated diphenyl ethers. And these are products that are widely used in personal products. So a lot of children's products, furniture, electronics, plastics, you can see the list there. And we're going to talk about sort of the routes to exposure and why we have concern and what policy alternatives we can do to address these concerns. These may be less familiar in terms of the name of them, flame retardants, if you haven't heard to them, but if you look at the bullet about the chemical composition, I wanted to talk about how they're structurally similar to PCBs. We've talked about some of the abandoned sites and challenges and what's left over from, you know, World War II kind of era things here in Alaska. We've talked about PCB exposure. This was brought up in our lunch and learn yesterday. So when we think about these and the chemicals, we don't want to just think about one particular variation or way that could be made, but we want to think about the family of chemicals, and we want to think about the chemicals that are structurally similar, and that's a key point of understanding how they impact human health, is think about the structure and the things that are structurally similar and then their impact on human health. These are also of concern because they bioaccumulate in blood, milk, breast, and fat tissues, which means that one exposure and then a second exposure and then a third exposure, those chemicals add up over time. And so, for example, some of the research that's been done, and we should be very concerned regarding subsistence foods, because the animals that eat at the top of the food chain have the most highly concentrated levels of these chemicals, because one eats on top of the next, right? So the bioaccumulation is a real reason that folks need to be concerned about these chemicals. And some additional health impacts for the PBDEs, specifically the thyroid hormone disruption. This is an endocrine disruption. The permanent learning and memory impairment, behavioral changes, and then, of course, the one of the leading causes of cancer for our firefighters. And just to give a history of where these flame retardants come from, if you think back, and that 1975 is really the piece I want to point to on this slide, this is where California passes a furniture flammability standards that leads furniture manufacturers to use large amounts of flame retardant chemicals. The chemicals are used in foam cushioning sold throughout the U.S. So if you look at the introduction of these chemicals, again, it's relatively recent. The year I was born, so I don't think of myself as that old just yet, relatively recent in terms of our scientific understanding. And why these chemicals were introduced, if you think back at that time, is that there were a lot of home fires, and a lot of them were happening because of cigarettes. And cigarettes that were not put out properly, and then they were burning on the couches around them or the chairs or the love seats, and they were burning that upholstery, and that was leading to the house fire. And, of course, you know, there could be damage, death, injury, a variety of very harmful and bad outcomes from that. So these chemicals were introduced as a way to sort of address that. But what's also happened in the time since then is that we don't have the problem with those same kind of cigarettes. The cigarettes are now all manufactured to be, you know, much less of a problem in that regard. Not truly self-extinguishing, but they don't, they've made some sort of physical modifications, if you will, to the way a cigarette is developed to prevent it from having that potential for starting the home fires. And if you look at the rates, they've gone down significantly. So it does bring up the question of whether these chemicals are needed in the same way they once were, because, again, a lot of things have changed since their introduction. And you can see all the way going to the 2016. This slide is actually from a nonprofit organization that does research in this area called the Environmental Working Group. And you can see in 2016, EWG detects carcinogenic PBDE replacements in California children at levels 15 times those of their moms. So there's significant exposure going on. And you'll see that also in 2016, what's happening is with increased consumer understanding of these risks, there's demand to get them out of the products. So here's how we're exposed. And if you just look at how this looks like the home that you live in and that your neighbors live in and that we, you know, all kind of live in, these are what we're talking about. So in upholstered furniture, right, these, again, came about because of these flammability standards that may or may not be necessary at the time, and plastic casing of some electronics, carpet padding with recycled foam, in the dust. And we really want to pay attention to the dust. That's a significant issue in Alaska because of our long winters. And we often have our houses sort of closed up for extended period of times because of the cold temperatures. So there's less airflow moving through, which means there's more dust accumulation. And when you see the image of the small child there, that's one of the main exposure routes for them as they're crawling around on the floor. And again, they're touching things and they're putting in their hands in their mouth and their toys are on the floor and they chew on their toys. They're getting these exposures over and over and over again. Here are some of the other products that we're concerned about that really, when we look through the lens of protecting children, children's mattresses, nap pads, changing pads, foam insulation, nursing pillows, all of these products and the foams and things that are used in them could contain these flame retardants. We talked about a couple of the big problems being endocrine disruption and the other being the cancer issue, and I know we have some firefighters are going to talk to the cancer issue a little bit more, and we're all fairly familiar with cancer, so I'm not going to kind of spend much time on that, although the stories are very compelling and just very upsetting to me that after these individuals have a career doing life-saving work that they are not able to live out their years in retirement because of the chemicals they were exposed to while doing that life-saving work. So we'll talk about that a little bit more through the public testimony and invited testimony. But on the endocrine disruption, just want to spend a moment on this. Our endocrine system is our hormone system, and we talked about the thyroid hormone disruption. And this may or may not be something that people know much about, so just want to spend sort of 1 minute talking about it. Our endocrine system you can think of as an on-demand system. And so the hormones that are produced by the endocrine system are really generally only produced at times when your body needs them. And that's sort of the on-demand system. We think of the pituitary gland as the control center. You know, there's messages that go from the pituitary gland to the other endocrine glands to tell them to make the hormones at the right time. But what happens during endocrine disruption is that those messages are interfered or messed up. And what's supposed to happen is it's really a lock and key relationship. And so that there's a receptor on one cell, and the hormone is like the key that fits into that receptor. But only this hormone should fit into that receptor. But what happens with these endocrine disrupting chemicals, and this is where we come back to the point about the chemical composition and the structure, is that these chemicals actually mimic or look like the same chemicals that are produced by your body. And so they interfere by confusing your body and taking the place of the natural hormone. And so it could lead to overproduction of a hormone. That's a bad thing. It could lead to underproduction. That's a bad thing. It could lead to release at the wrong time. Those are all bad things because of the way it's naturally intended to work. And so what you can see in the picture here at the top is what a normal situation should look like, where the hormone fits into the receptor and they have that lock and key relationship. They both fit just where they're supposed to. But then you can see in the picture below, this is a situation where it says hormone mimic. You know, this represents the chemical that's in our environment that mimics the natural hormone, so it fits into that receptor even though it's not supposed to. And that is the problem with what's happening with exposure to the chemicals, is that they get into our bodies and they're fitting in the places that they're not supposed to be and causing any number of bad health outcomes, which when we look to endocrine system disruption, these are some of the bad outcomes, because you have to think about what the endocrine system does. So, for example, the thyroid-related disorders, we know the thyroid hormones are important in regulating metabolism. The immune function, that's also part of your endocrine system. Our reproductive organs are considered part of our endocrine system. Metabolic disorders, again, going back to the thyroid gland. So anytime, you know, these glands that are part of the endocrine system are, you know, having these chemicals come into your body that interfere with what's supposed to be happening naturally, it can lead to any number of these bad outcomes. So what's the policy solution? That's what brings us to House Bill 27 today. And what we do with House Bill 27 is first restrict the use of the known chemicals of concern. So these are the ones that have been substantiated to cause harm, the certain PBDEs, the certain flame retardants. And then we restrict the use of possible substitutes, because one of the challenges in doing this regulatory work is that you might restrict one, and we've talked about this sort of in the illegal drug context, only to have some new form come along right after that's equally concerning or equally problematic. And that's why, back to the the slide where I talk about the family of chemicals can make over 200 related chemicals. So we can't just think about banning one of them. We really have to think about how many of them are similar enough that they would confuse our body and cause the same problems. It also has provisions in there where we would conduct Alaska research. One of the areas that, and this isn't unique to Alaska, but it's just a real problem nationwide, is not having enough research looking at specifics to climate in Alaska, specifics to the population of Alaskans. Some work has been done with Alaska Native women and testing breast milk. Some of the most important work that even brought attention to these issues was done in Canada, testing the breast milk of women in the far north regions of the Yukon Territory and Northwest Territories. And when we found the results, we're surprised to see that the breast milk contained chemicals that weren't in use in Canada, weren't in use in Alaska, but maybe were used elsewhere, but because of global wind and water patterns are transported to the Arctic, and people are familiar with the concept of acid rain. In the same way, when these chemicals are transported to the Arctic, and then people are exposed to them in that similar way. It also calls on us to collaborate with other states, because, again, it's very challenging to do this kind of health research, very costly, very time-consuming. And what we would ask is the state of Alaska to collaborate with other states so that we can benefit from the work that they're doing and they can benefit from the work that we might do. That concludes my PowerPoint presentation introduction.
Okay. You ready for some questions?
Sure.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it safe to say that you're not satisfied with the federal government protections that are afforded children, grandchildren, basically in the clothing line and whatnot? Because this seems to be kind of stepping into a federally mandated program, and it sounds expensive just from the standpoint of the state of Alaska kind of inserting itself into the, how clothing is going to be designed. And again, through the chair or co-chair, I guess I'm just trying to, it seems to me that if you go to Consumer Reports, and I did go to Consumer Reports and I looked it up, and they talk about, there's some noise about, fire retardants and stuff, but the fact is that there's fewer children burned as a result of that. And why our state out of 50 states do we dive into this? Through the chair.
Through the chair to Representative Birch, Alaska's not the only state doing this. There's legislation under consideration in about 30 different states on a number of these topics. And people have been dissatisfied with the length of time that it's taken to get reforms through the federal government. And that's why I wanted to start with the origins of some of the regulations, because they go back more than 100 years. And so much has changed in the time. What we know about human health, what we know certainly about developmental health, that is much more recent. What we've learned since the completion of the Human Genome Project, there have been significant gains, but just more in the last 10 and 15 years in our understanding of human health. And we're learning more and more these days that we didn't know before, and it's just that simple. We didn't know some of these things before. That's why, some of those chemicals that were grandfathered in without testing for adverse human health effects or long-term environmental impacts are a problem. And I think it's more of a partnership. A lot of states are taking on this kind of work. That's why it's good that we would collaborate with each other, because it is, in fact, costly to complete this work. But we should think of it more like a partnership. The work we do at the state level, we can share with the federal government. The work that they do can inform the work that we do. And hopefully, by everybody working together, we'll get the important human health information that we need. Additionally, we really shouldn't look at this sort of as a, something that should hold us back, because the kind of, research, the kind of ingenuity that it took to develop the projects we're using today, we have that same kind of skill and talent to develop the products for tomorrow. And really what I see is this is actually a huge opportunity for new product development. It's not that there aren't alternatives. There are alternatives that we know that are safer alternatives. And it's just a matter of transitioning into those safer alternatives, new product development. One thing people might be familiar with is BPA, for example, bisphenol A. We learned that that was having adverse human health effects. We still haven't been able to outlaw that or make the significant gains in the regulatory world that we want, but you'd be hard-pressed to find a plastic bottle or something that has BPA anymore because there's so much consumer pressure to get that, you know, harmful chemical off the shelves out of the products that we use every day. That also started because it was used in baby bottles and products that small children who are still developing were using. And basically through the mommy blogs, this kind of information was shared, spread like wildfire, and the consumer behavior changed as a result. And so you don't see those products anymore. So it's a matter of the federal government, the state government, researchers, consumers, everybody's got to, you know, work together and figure out how we move forward. But I think there's a huge opportunity here for new product development and looking at, you know, sustainable products and taking what we've learned and moving forward with the things that are going to work for us in the next century.
Follow up,
Representative.
I've got four grade school age grandkids, and they sleep over a lot, and I'm quite comfortable with them being in their fireproof jammies when they go to bed in our house. And I guess, you know, with the support of the consumer, I mean, I look forward to learning, but at this point, it just seems to me like it's a fire retardant compared to the consequence. The adverse consequences is reasonable to have in our lives, and until I learn otherwise. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let me ask.
Can I just please respond to that? Because
yes.
Through the chair to Representative Birch, your grandkids would not have them in their jammies because they were taken out of pajamas because they're dangerous for children. And that's one change that has happened, actually. So previously they were used in those kind of clothing, but that, because we know how dangerous they are, they're no longer used in those products. But what they are used in is the other products in your home. And so those are the ones we're concerned about, and I think we can find other alternatives. So, for example, you can have a wool rug. It's naturally fire resistant. You don't need to add chemicals to it. Or you can have the synthetic fibers that you perhaps need to. Also, we can be more careful with our cigarettes, with our candles, with, you know, making sure that we've done a good job in our homes to reduce to the extent we can any fire danger.
Thank you.
And before I get to Representative Parrish, who was next in the queue, I have a question, and the legal analysis must be similar to the GMO labeling issue. What is your understanding, Representative Tarr, about, I'm looking at Section 2, the requirement that we would label or require that manufacturers label something as containing a chemical flame retardant. Are we allowed to do that, to your understanding?
Through the chair, or to the co-chair, yes, we are allowed to require labeling. There are interstate commerce clause when you regulate what chemicals are allowed to be used, but you can regulate what products are allowed to be sold and whether those products have to be labeled.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, you mentioned that 30 states are considering action. Do any already have such a law on the books?
Through the chair to Representative Parrish, yes, several states have passed one, and Rhode Island, I believe, was the most recent state to pass that, and I apologize, I don't have the list, but we can certainly provide that of all of the states that are considering, and I believe there's something in your packet that has a map that shows that, but I'm put together a list and share that. I believe Rhode Island was the most recent one, and what we see with the Rhode Island legislation is a reflection is reflected in our legislation, where we're trying to address a class of chemicals rather than just have a list of individual chemicals, because, again, what we've seen happen is that as soon as you're able to address one, then another one comes along that could be as concerning or even more concerning. So the substitutions have become a big issue, and so now looking towards looking at the class of chemicals.
Follow up.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Actually, I suppose it's more of a separate question. Will someone in the course of the studies be presenting, or in the course of the presentations, be talking about any kind of mouse study or other experiment which gets at a more causative relationship?
through the chair to Representative Parrish, we do have two healthcare professionals on that are more experienced in that area, including one member, faculty member, who I believe will be able to talk to some of the specifics of studies.
Wonderful. I'll wait till then.
And I do want to, if I could, Mr. Chair, point to a handout that I believe is in your packet from Safer States, talks about toxic flame retardants. 22 current policies in 14 states and 33 adopted policies in 13 states. So it shows the map on here and the ones that are under consideration and the ones that have already been adopted. So hopefully that will be helpful. And if you don't have that, I'll make sure you get a copy.
Thank you.
And Representative Tarr, I see in the packet a lot of interest and concern and support from the West Coast, really approaching the northwest of Alaska near the Seward Peninsula. And we saw a lunch and learn yesterday about the impacts of chemicals left behind. Well, first of all, the same weather trends and sort of ocean trends that you talked about, or pathways for distribution of toxins. But the other thing were chemicals left behind, just as we heard in a previous bill, by DOD, Department of Defense, and so I see a particular interest in places like Savunga and Elam and all over the Seward Peninsula. Can you speak to that at all?
Sure, and I think some of our invited testimony will add to this. And I should have just used this term. When we talk about the thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. When we talk about that phenomenon of travel to the Arctic, we call it the grasshopper effect. And so it's the sort of amplification of what happens as these things travel to the Arctic and in these colder temperatures become more stable, and then, you know, we're exposed to them. The folks on St. Lawrence Island, and we'll definitely hear about that, have been working on chemical exposures for quite a number of years. They have a lot of these abandoned DOD sites, and then additionally the impact from global transport and the grasshopper effect. And, you know, what I know has been concerned is, you know, high rates of cancer in a small population, also things related to infertility and miscarriages being very concerning. And then in subsistence foods, through the work that I've done over the years on this with one of the organizations, I think that will present today, Alaska Community Action on Toxics, much better versed to speak to the specifics. But folks have contacted their office, I know, when they've gone out subsistence hunting, and when, you know, the thing that is so wonderful about getting that information is that the traditional hunting is where folks are using every part of the animal. And so they're really paying attention to what the organs look like. And they're really paying attention to whether there's anything that looks abnormal. And this is information that's been passed down from generation to generation to generation. And so you hear people saying, you know, they don't, there's no record of this, right? The kind of abnormalities they're seeing, there's no record of it. Nobody, you know, passed this down in their oral traditions. And they, when they were taught about hunting, nobody talked about the kinds of things they're seeing. So even though those aren't sort of conducted by a university kind of studies, I think that kind of information is very powerful, and we need to really be listening to that, as you know, and give it credit like the other kind of information we take in is from science.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Drummond, and I think we need to get on to hearing some of the invited testimony right away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of a comment and then a question. As a member of the Anchorage Municipal Assembly, I had the misfortune to attend two funerals of firefighters in Anchorage who died as a result of the exposure to chemicals like this in their work as firefighters, the folks who run into fires instead of away from them on our behalf. And that, I don't want to see that happening again. And I'm glad that this is targeting the same chemicals that impact firefighters as impact our children. In terms of bioaccumulation, presentation talks about chemicals bioaccumulate in blood, breast milk, and fat tissues. Blood can be replaced. Breast milk naturally leaves the body into the baby, and fat tissues. When these substances bioaccumulate, do they ever reduce in amount? Is there a way to clear them from the tissues, from muscles and fat tissues and bones? of the body?
Through the chair to Representative Drummond, these chemicals, in terms of the bioaccumulation in fat tissue, what will likely happen is when that is metabolized, then the chemicals are released. And that's where you want to be concerned about the adverse health effects, because then that, you know, basically becomes part of what's exposed, you know, what you're being exposed to in your body. The other reason we're concerned about that is if you think about whaling, for example, and the part of the animal that's being eaten and those animals being at the top of the food chain, the bioaccumulation in that context means that when you eat that as a food, you could be exposed to higher accumulations of those chemicals because it's being stored in the fat tissue. So there's sort of two ways to look at that, whether it's, you know, fat tissue in your own body and metabolizing and exposure, or whether you're being exposed through the foods you eat because, you know, as you move up the food chain and each phase as you move up the food chain becomes more and more concerning.
Mm-hmm. And concentrates the mm-hmm. concentrates. Follow-up?
Briefly. Follow-up?
Briefly. I love having these biology lessons. Metabolizing your own fat stores and other tissues in your body, how does that occur, that you metabolize your own fat?
Well, if you think about someone, through the chair, like when someone, you know, loses weight and you're not consuming as many calories as your body is burning, and so your body looks to your fat tissue, that's a storage tissue, and that's its essential function. And so when you're not taking in the number of calories you are burning, then your body looks to that as the energy source.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So I think we're ready for a very brief at ease, and then we're going to be at ease for about 20 seconds, I think.
Dr. Veena Singla. She's from the University of California, San Francisco's Program on Reproductive Health and the Environment. And we're going to try to limit our invited testimony here to a few minutes each so that we make sure we get through everyone and then through all of the business that we have today.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. My name is Veena Singla, and I'm a scientist at the University of California, San Francisco Program on Reproductive Health and the Environment. My program's mission is to create a healthier environment for human reproduction and development through advancing scientific inquiry, clinical care, and health policies that prevent exposures to harmful chemicals in our environment. An important note is that flame retardants in furniture and children's products have been found to be ineffective and unnecessary for slowing and preventing fires. Research at the Consumer Product Safety Commission and the California Bureau of Home Furnishings found no difference in the fire behavior of furniture with or without flame retardants, and also that flame retardants are not needed in children's products. And I'd be happy to share those studies. In 2016, I published a study which found that 10 organohalogen flame retardants are widespread in the indoor dust of our homes, schools, and other buildings. These chemicals have health hazards, including cancer, reproductive, and developmental toxicity. Flame retardant chemicals are added to furniture and children's products, but they don't stay there. They migrate out and contaminate indoor air and dust. And as we heard, this contaminated air and dust are major ways that flame retardants can enter our bodies, and especially children's bodies, when they breathe in, touch, and accidentally ingest this air and dust. And as we also heard, children are not little adults. Their developing bodies and behaviors put them particularly at risk for flame retardant exposures. They breathe more for their body size than adults, and they have close contact with these baby products and much more contact with contaminated dust when they crawl and play on the floor and put their hands in their mouths. So we see that infants and young children, on average, have 3 to 15 times greater levels of flame retardants in their bodies compared to their moms. And infants with more baby products in the home tend to have higher flame retardant levels, up to 100 times greater than their moms. This is a serious concern because children's brains and bodies are uniquely vulnerable to the effects of toxic chemicals. So just like lead is especially poisonous to children while their brains are developing, other chemicals are too. Our comprehensive review of human evidence on PBDE flame retardants published last year in 2017 found that flame retardant exposures before birth are associated with loss of IQ in children. And furthermore, early life exposures to cancer-causing chemicals can increase cancer risks for the entire lifespan through adulthood. Data from numerous studies shows that when there are fewer flame-retardant products in a room, the levels in air, dust, and people goes down. Limiting flame retardants in products is an effective and evidence-based approach to reduce harmful chemicals in our children's bodies. And thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Singla. Are there any questions for the doctor? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Doctor, for your testimony. Are you aware of any experiments which have done to see if a causal relationship can be established? Not in humans, clearly, but in other model species?
Yes. So a number of these flame retardants have extensive toxicological testing establishing these various toxicities. So, for example, the neurodevelopmental toxicity of PBDE flame retardants or the cancer-causing properties of some of these other flame retardants. The National Toxicology Program has done extensive testing on a number of these flame retardants in animal studies finding these health hazards.
Thank you.
And Dr. Singla, if you would send some of those, then we'll be sure to share those with our committee members.
Yes, I'd be happy to.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And in the interest of time, because we have such a lineup here, I'm going to continue on. Next is Alex Boyd. He's the Assistant Chief and Assistant Chief Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. Is Alex available?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, could you please? Oh, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, we spent 45 minutes rolling out this this proposal, and we've had, I'm assuming, several. When do you intend to conclude public testimony on this?
I will see where we're at. That's just how we'll have to go because we have three items before us today.
Representative Birch, is this not entertaining enough for you?
No, I just want to. I hope the other side, if you will, if there is another side, has an opportunity. I mean, you're kind of picking on the, you know, going down the witness list here, if you will, and the testifiers. I just don't know what you're.
We're in an invited testimony. That's right. Right now, we're not in public testimony. We're in invited testimony. So that's why we're have the individuals.
Are there any divergent opinions on the invited list?
Well, that I'll leave up to you to decide as you hear them. So I'm going to continue on with Alex Boyd from the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. Mr. Boyd.
Yes, for the record, Alex Boyd, Assistant Chief, Anchorage Fire Department. I'm speaking on behalf of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I will keep my comments brief and thank the representative for bringing this forward as well as the committee for allowing us to hear. As a firefighter, I signed on, as did many of my colleagues, to assist our community. And what we're finding in later careers as I reach my 23rd year in the service, the firefighters are being found to be 2 to 6 times more likely to be diagnosed with cancer in and after their careers, resulting in a lifespan, several studies are suggesting, up to 25 to 30 years shorter than the average citizen. With that, we don't believe that that's completely contributed to organohalogens. However, they are definitely contributing to the process and the toxins that we encounter in the process of fighting fire. With that perspective, I would like to say that we, the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, are in support of this bill and would be willing to answer any specific questions about it. But again, I will keep my comment short other than to probably support the bill.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate your testimony, Mr. Boyd. Any questions for Mr. Boyd? Okay, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to go next to Jeff Tucker, Fire Chief from the Kenai Firefighters Association.
Yeah, good afternoon. My name is Jeff Tucker. I'm the president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm calling again in favor of passage of HB 27. Representative Tarr did a great job on getting the history of the use of the chemicals, and I will not try to repeat that. As pointed out, flame retardants began to be widely used in the 70s when California passed legislation with the intent to protect lives. Unfortunately, as well as we are well aware, sometimes decisions made in the past sometimes are proven not to bear out with passage of time and the advancements of science. The fire protection that was hoped for from these chemicals is just not there. On the contrary, studies have now shown that these flame retardants contain, as was discussed, highly toxic carcinogens. Today's firefighters are suffering ever more increasing risk of exposure from toxic atmospheres with the furnishings in today's homes. Firefighters dying from occupational-related cancers now nationally account for over half of the line-of-duty deaths each year. Alaska has been mentioned, has not been immune from this ugly statistic, as we have seen line-of-duty firefighter deaths from cancer and have been directly related to job-related exposure. The Alaska legislature has recognized the risk of firefighters face by enacting legislation that provides presumptive coverage for disabilities from diseases, including certain cancers that have been directly linked to these flame retardants. We as a fire service have begun to take more proactive steps to reduce our exposure to carcinogens by instituting new procedures and adopting new technologies to protect our firefighters. However, that is not enough, and you guys can help with that. I want to point out one thing that was mentioned earlier about fire-safe cigarettes. Representative Tarr mentioned them earlier with regards to this, one of the reasons that flame retardants began to be used. The fire-safe cigarette initiatives were a state initiative. It began in the early 2000s, and in 2007, Alaska adopted Senate Bill 84, which became law. And in 2012, all 50 states enacted legislation for fire-safe cigarettes. So that was a state initiative, as this is a state initiative, as opposed to a federal initiative. Because of the inherent risk and exposure we face as firefighters, and on behalf of the members of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association and firefighters across the state, I encourage the committee to pass HB 27 to protect those firefighters who serve your communities from these toxic cancer-causing chemicals. And thank you, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Tucker. Do we have any questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tucker. The difficulty I can see and hear how dangerous these chemicals are that are in our homes and buildings and furnishings, but how do we get rid of the ones that are already there? I understand that when we buy new furnishings, build new structures, furnish these structures, carpet these structures, we can avoid these chemicals, but as a firefighter and representing firefighters who have to deal with these chemicals in the environments that they run into every day, how are we going to rid ourselves of furnishings that are already here that in many cases in Alaska, because we're kind of the end of the line in terms of the logistics line of delivery of products and products ending up in at the end of the road in villages and communities all over the state, whose final stop may be a landfill, but in the meantime they are firmly ensconced in people's homes and businesses. How do we clear those furnishings out of our environments?
Representative, through the chair, I don't know how we get rid of those. I know in the fire service, what we've done is we've started to take proactive steps and basically have started treating structure fires differently than we have in the past. Back when it was, you know, we were fighting wood-framed homes with, you know, natural materials in their cottons and wools. You know, we're treating fires now as a hazardous materials response. And, you know, we're starting to initiate procedures where we're decontaminating our firefighters on scene and providing them with higher technology equipment, hoods that have membranes in them that will protect them from the toxins. So we're treating it as a hazmat response, hazardous materials response. And that's unfortunate we have to do that, but because of what the chemicals that are in and being produced in homes, we're doing that. How you get rid of them, I don't know if you can, other than through attrition. But being proactive and preventing more such chemicals being put into homes, I think, is the positive step we can take.
Follow-up?
quickly.
Thank you, sir. I have seen in touring fire stations the cleaning process, the washing process of the turnout equipment that is worn by firefighters. Does that have a limited effect, or does that get rid of a significant portion of these chemicals that are picked up in the line of duty?
Representative Food Chair, the commercial washing machines that we use do a very good job of getting rid of those chemicals. What we're doing now, many departments across the state that have the ability to do that are actually purchasing two sets of gears for their firefighters so that when we respond to a fire, you know, the gear that we take off can be taken back and decontaminated, you know, through those washing machines, and then we have a second set of gear to do it. But that is a positive step that we have taken, and it does a tremendous amount to do it. But it's the exposure on the scene when we're working on the fires. It's not only the respiratory exposure, but it's also through skin contact that we're exposed to these chemicals. So protecting our firefighters, protecting the equipment that we respond in and respond with is really our concern, what we're doing proactively to do this.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Chairman.
Okay, next we have Allison Talley of the Learning Disability Association of America. If you could please join us. And thank you, Mr. Tucker. Really appreciate that.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 27, and thank you, Representatives Tarr and Josephson, for sponsoring this bill. My name is Allison Talley. I live in Juneau and am the mother of three adopted children, all of them born in Alaska. Two of my children have learning disabilities, and I'm a volunteer with the Learning Disabilities Association of Alaska. I'll provide you with copies of my written testimony in support of this bill. It has a lot of information, and I encourage you to read it and to refer to all of the many citations of research and studies that are included in it. But since I have such limited time, I'd like to use my spoken testimony to highlight just a few things. First, a really shocking statistic. It was reported in an article published in Pediatrics and cited by the CDC that in 2008, one in six children in the United States were reported to have a developmental or a learning disability. That means language-based learning disabilities, autism, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and others. One in six. And that's an increase of 17% in 10 years. And here's another shocker. Between 1997 and 2008, the prevalence of ADHD rose by 33%. And now the biggest shocker of all, during that same period of time, the prevalence of autism rose by 290%. Wow. And here's the reason that it's so important for you to hear this. The National Academy of Sciences has reported that environmental factors, including toxic chemicals like flame retardants, contribute to or cause 28% of these disabilities. Over a quarter of disabilities, like learning problems, ADHD, and autism, are caused in part by exposure to toxic chemicals that are found in everyday household products. Science clearly shows that toxic chemicals like flame retardants can affect and change babies' brains. Even low levels of exposure can cause intellectual and developmental disabilities. And those disabilities last a lifetime. Have you ever spent time at the dining room table helping with homework? Was it ever frustrating? As I said earlier, I'm the mother of two children with learning disabilities, and homework time at my house wasn't frustrating. It was heartbreaking. My kids thought they weren't as smart as everyone else. They weren't as good as everyone else. They weren't as worthwhile as everybody else. It took all their courage every day just to go to school, and it took all of mine to send them. If exposure to toxic chemicals might have contributed even a small amount to the heartbreak that was so frequently present at my dining room table, well, I can only say that I wish that kind of heartbreak on no other family. If we can do anything to prevent damage by toxic chemicals to developing brains, we have to do it. You have to do it. Please adopt the Toxic Free Children Act. Please protect Alaska's children from flame retardants that put them at higher risk for developmental and learning disabilities. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Talley. We really appreciate the stories that you were willing to share in your testimony. Any questions for our guest? Okay.
Well, here's my written testimony.
And our committee aide here, Thatcher, can help with that, and we'll certainly distribute that to everyone. Those are the invited testimony, but we have quite a lineup of regular testimony, and so we'll have to limit that to no more than 2 minutes. And so I'm going to have to be very on top of this to use the timer today because we have so many folks here wanting to testify. And let me just check, is Dominic Lozano here? No. Okay, so we'll take that person off that list as potentially someone. So I'm just going to start calling names, and again, I'm going to be timing, and I will have to cut you off. I apologize. So we have Jasmine Gemawook from Anchorage. Jasmine, are you there? Okay, we're going to continue on to Christy Apengaluk from Gamble. Is Christy there? Christy, if you could please.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes. State your name and affiliation for the record.
Hi, good afternoon from St. Lawrence Island. My name is Christy Apengaluk. I'm calling to testify on behalf of ACAT. And can I start?
Yeah. Can you please continue?
Okay. I'm a mother of a 6-year-old boy, and I'm expecting another child in May. And being a mother of flame retardant really need to be banned. It is personal to be, because we live on an island, a isolated rural village in Alaska. We're always cooped up at home, inside during storms. And we have, you know, we get exposed a lot more that way because of furniture. And I really want HB 27 to be passed so everything can be safer. You know, it's scary, especially expecting another child and buying furniture that has, most likely has flame retardants in it. I really don't like that. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. We really appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Okay, thank you so much. Is Abel Bolt-Ito available in Fairbanks?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, please go ahead. We're strict 2-minute limit here.
Yes, I will not need 2 minutes. So my name is Abel Bultito. I'm a professor of neurobiology and anatomy, and I'm at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, so this call is from Fairbanks. I just want to make sure that you know that I do not speak for the university, but for myself as an expert in behavioral neuroscience. I am in very strong support of this bill, and I would like to thank Representative Tarr for introducing it. There were some questions about causality of flame retardants and effects on behavior, and there's many studies on animals that show that causal relationship. For example, very low doses in zebrafish treated with flame retardants will change behavior dramatically, both in the larvae and as well as in the adults. And even in some of the very low doses where there's no effect on the larvae, these researchers have found large effect in the adults. Flame retardants at levels comparable to exposures in people have shown to decrease attention span in rats. They have affected neural development in mice. So there's a host of studies out there that show that flame retardants are very harmful substances, especially for developing animals, and I would assume for developing people as well. So I'm in strong support of this bill, and I hope you'll pass it. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you. We appreciate your time. Representative Parrish has a question.
Thank you. It's good to hear from you again, Professor Bultito. And thank you for referring us to those studies. If you could forward the ones on rats and mice, I'd certainly appreciate that. Also, would...
I will do so. Thank you.
Thank you. If there's a more comprehensive list of chemicals which have clearly indicated adverse consequences which aren't on a federally restricted list, I'd be interested in knowing what document people in your line of work would point to as more or less a reliable source.
Well, you know, for me, I just go to the National Institutes of Health PubMed website and put in search functions like flame retardants and brain development, and tons of papers will come up that show you the effects of these toxics. So, but I will send additional information to Representative Tarr in the next couple of days.
Thank you.
Thank you. Continuing on, Tomos, I'm going to mess up the names here. Azamizitz, from the American Chemical Association from Charlottesville, California.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead and state your name
and
affiliation.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I'm speaking at the request of the American Chemistry Council. Two things I'd like to point out.
You need to state your name, please, for the record and affiliation before your testimony.
Sure.
Thank you.
My name is Tomos Azamizitz, and I'm speaking at the request of the American Chemistry Council.
Okay.
And two things I'd like to comment on. It really fits in with some of the discussion so far. I think the idea of looking at hazard, and that's what we've been talking about so far, various effects have been shown in animal studies, et cetera, is a very important starting point. But the most important thing to consider is the actual exposure that children or other people are going to receive. So bringing the concept of risk into deciding what chemicals should be regulated and what priority, I think, is very important. There's some examples of chemicals that have gone through extensive reviews, including the ones you cite, which is TCPP, one of the ones that's called out. There have been extensive risk assessments done both by the European Union and by Environment Canada, and several publications since then as well that I can share with you that show when that chemical has been examined in detail, there are no adverse effects to be expected. Similarly, just with regard to TCPP, again, you're calling that out, but that chemical does not meet the criteria that you would use for actually being on the list of chemical concern of high concern. It's not neurotoxic. It's not classified as a carcinogen, reproductive toxic, or an endocrine disruptor. It's not a PBT, persistent bioaccumulative toxic chemical. So I think my main comments are two things. One, think very clearly about the exposure, not just the hazard associated with the chemical. Take a look at risk assessments and the process that's been made and use that to prioritize what should be regulated. And two, I would argue against calling out specific chemicals unless they've gone rigorously through whatever decision tree you put together.
Thank you. Appreciate
your testimony. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
I'm happy to answer questions. I'm speaking as a toxicologist who's looked at this area for quite a few years.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today. Representative Birch has a question.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. I've worked in and around the oil patch a lot, and there's a lot of halon that's used as a fire retardant, or I should say a fire suppressor. What typically, what's in the fire extinguisher that's in everybody's house, or should be multiple fire extinguishers? What's the operative chemical in a fire extinguisher that basically hopefully does the job in knocking down a fire in our homes? Through the chair?
That's not my expertise as a toxicologist, but from personal experience, I know that there's some bromine-containing molecules sometimes, and that's probably where halon comes from, halogen. So I think bromine and some other chemicals are used in there that are used to suppress the fire, but that's really as far as I can tell you.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay, continuing on here.
Madam Chair.
I'm so sorry. Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, sir, for calling in. I heard you say to be cautious against calling out specific chemicals or classes of chemicals. I, too, have that concern because I know that when a single molecule changes, all of a sudden you're talking about a different chemical. Can you direct us to some resource that would help specify the class of chemicals without limiting to a specific formulation? I don't know if I have the language correct, but I hear you when you say be cautious about specifics.
Sure, and through the chair, let me explain. explain what I mean, and maybe this will help you understand my perspective. And that is, if you look at the chemicals that are specifically listed in the bill, they're quite different in their properties, and they're quite different in the toxicology related to them. I mentioned TCPP, the third one on the list here, that's specified in the legislation. And that one, as I mentioned, is not a PBT. It's not a carcinogen. It's not considered any of those bad hazard properties that are listed in how you'd identify chemicals of high concern for children's exposure. So that alone illustrates the point of why it's important to look at each chemical individually as opposed to make broad sweeping statements. Some of the things which the people testified before me with regard to HPCDs, the diphenyl ethers, that's true for diphenyl ethers, but those are not remotely related in biological effects to some of the other flame retardants. So again, the basis for this may be concern about those molecules which have been used extensively in the past, but to group that whole flame retardant category with the same brush really doesn't fit the science and it really doesn't make good public policy. And that's where I think it's important to start with not just the criteria which you have here, which I think is reasonable, and then remember that the exposure ultimately is what matters. And the exposure will then allow you to prioritize what chemicals are most important to regulate because that's where you'll get the biggest public health improvement. But as it's written right now, I think an awful lot of energy and time would be misspent listing chemicals that if they're banned or not, will have no effect on exposure to people and will have no public health benefit by doing that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Parrish, and we're really, really pressed for time, so I just want to make that request if we can try to get to everybody if it works.
Certainly.
Representative Parrish.
And thank you, sir, for calling in and for your testimony. What is the process that a chemical goes through to be approved? What animal trials or other trials are conducted to make sure that a chemical is safe before it can be used in a consumer product?
To the chair. Well, I'll let one of the other people after me speak to the details with regard to the current regulations, but I know the chemicals, for example, TCPP has gone through extensive testing. Many of the newer chemicals that are being developed, and this is where some of my experience is helping companies not just in this realm but other areas develop new chemicals and test for all the various properties, much of which you have listed here. So there's extensive data on many of these chemicals. Again, I'm not familiar with all of it, but I could refer you to one of the EPA alternative assessments they did on various flame-retarding chemicals. I can send references to you where the EPA actually lists some of the various properties that are associated with some of the flame retardants. And that's a pretty good compendium of what either the EPA has available or what they've predicted. So that gives you an idea that really there has been an awful lot of work that's gone into these, especially in the last 20 years. A totally different world in toxicology and product development than it was 20 years ago. I'd say even now, looking forward, it's much different than it was 10 years ago as far as the due diligence and the care that goes into developing new molecules.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if you'd please send that in.
Sure. And we will distribute all of this information. Emma Pate from the Norton Sound Health Corporation.
Hello, this is Emma Pate, and I'm calling from Norton Sound Health Corporation.
Please go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you for the opportunity to call in and testify. And I was born in Alaska and raised in the Bering Strait region, which is the area that Norton Sound Health Corporation serves. And we strongly advocate for the House Bill 27, to protect the health and safety of Alaskan children. In reviewing the facts provided by the Alaska Community Action on Toxics, the organohalogen flame retardant chemical has immediate and long-term damaging effects on the health of all Alaskans, and our Alaskan children are the most vulnerable to these toxins. So those of us in Alaska with the capacity to take action to protect our children need to do so. All Alaskans, including firefighters in public service that may receive high levels when exposed to smoke infused with these chemicals, need protection within their best interest through this bill. And so the facts that are provided that substantiate immediate action on behalf of Alaskans is found through multiple studies. And we also submitted a letter of support from our president and CEO. So that was routed through the email process. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Pate. We really appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Okay, we're going to keep going on to Patty Saunders. And
my name is Patty Saunders. I live in Anchorage. I am representing myself today. I am very fortunate to have many children in my life. I'm a grandmother, an aunt, an honorary aunt, and a special friend to my amazing four-year-old neighbor. I love them all beyond measure. I should not have to be a chemist or a researcher with PhD-level investigative skills to make sure that the toys and other gifts I buy for these precious children are not causing them harm.
Can you speak up just a bit? We're having some trouble hearing you.
Okay.
This is better.
Out now.
Much better.
All right, I'm sorry. I am very fortunate to have many children in my life. I'm a grandmother, honorary aunt, and special friend to an amazing four-year-old neighborhood. I love them all beyond measure. I should not have to be a chemist or a researcher with PhD-level investigative skills to make sure that the toys and other gifts I buy for these precious children are not causing them harm because of toxic ingredients that we know are linked to cancer, neurological defects, and adult reproductive difficulties. I am deeply offended by this suggestion of the American Chemistry Council representative that we should defer our regulation of unnecessary and ineffective flame retardant chemicals until someone other than ACC's clients pay for studies to prove they're harmful, and that Alaska children should not be protect its children from those chemicals. Please support HB 27 to start fixing this problem by banning organohalogen flame retardants, which hurt our children, our families, and our neighbors, while providing no meaningful fire safety benefits. Thank you.
Thank you. Really appreciate your testimony. Any questions for Ms. Saunders? Okay, there's a couple other folks online. I want to make note with the toy. Let me just double check here because we're going to run out of time, and I want to let you know what I'm going to do. The Toy Association, the American Chemistry Council, and the Juvenile Products Manufacturers Association, some of those folks from Washington, D.C. So because I know those folks are paid every day to come to work to do this work, I'm going to go to the other folks first, and if we run out of time, we'll keep public testimony open and hope you that you will join us for the next meeting. Next, I'm going to go to John Kenish in Anchorage.
Hello.
Hi there. If you could please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is John Kenish. I'm a retired professor from University of Alaska Anchorage. I'm really speaking for myself as a experienced chemist. I was an analytical chemist for 50 years, and I actually worked on Tristan Fireol flame retardants years ago, studies of the metabolism and distribution of these chemicals in rats. It was funded under the National Toxicology Program. The net result of these compounds is that they break down rapidly to produce free radicals. One of the free radicals, of course, is the halogen, which is either chlorine or bromine, and that's what they react with oxygen to terminate the actual flame itself by removing the oxygen from the flame. So the result of it is you produce these compounds, which are very reactive. Free radicals just mean that they have a free electron. They can react spontaneously with anything. So inside of the body of an organism, they will react with any kind of cell tissue that's present, any kind of chemical entities there, and that's a real problem. These compounds typically, and children's physiology years ago, were absorbed through the skin. And, of course, that means that there's some level of those compounds in children who are sleeping in these clothing. And, of course, the same thing happens in your household furniture, because when you sit on it for a certain period of time, you're going to absorb some of those chemicals through your body. But it was found that they were absorbed fastest by around the stomach area. And that's why little children wearing these pajamas was really a bad idea. Net result, though, is that we now have materials we can make clothing to get around this fire code, which are not toxic in this respect. in this particular instance, and so this is an area that we should be using. We should be eliminating these chemicals that are absorbed, metabolically converted, and reacting within your cells with other materials that are not going to be toxic to the person being exposed. And I remember a few years back, a whole bunch of people were analyzed in Anchorage with regards to these chemical exposures, and I think lawyers were the most highly contaminated because they sat in treated chairs the most during their work day. So it tells you something about the fact that it's not just kids that are being exposed, but everyone is being exposed at some level for compounds that are highly reactive. So if there's any other questions you'd like to know about that, I would be glad to talk about the details of the metabolic studies. But realistically, once the chemicals are in the body, the free radicals are produced, and they're basically react with everything in the tissue. Also, the free radicals, once they're exposed to the flame, are reactive, and that's why people who are working on fighting fires get exposed to really toxic reactive chemicals. That's all I have to add to my comments.
Thank you so much. We have a question from Representative Drummond.
Yes, very quickly. Thank you, sir, for calling in. Did you participate in these investigations that you're telling us about?
Yeah, I did. I worked on these chemicals at the Oregon Health Sciences Center and the Department of Pharmacology in roughly 1977 through roughly 1980. That was before I came up to Anchorage. I came up to Anchorage in 79, but I actually worked during the summer sometimes up at the Oregon Health Sciences Center working on studying the metabolism and distribution. So we actually figured out from when the compounds were taking up where they ended up in the body. A lot of them, because of the free radicals, much of it got consumed or burned up and released as carbon dioxide, but about 20% of it ended up being distributed throughout the tissues at the end of the study, which meant they were chemically bound in some form to various parts of cells and other tissue in the body.
I would appreciate it, sir, if we could have citations for some of these for the most recent work.
I did send copies of my data to Representative Tarr, who I asked her to distribute it, but I can give you more specific ones if you like.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Okay, and my request for the next folks, if we could slim down to even 1 minute of testimony, because we will need to wrap this up in just a couple of minutes for today.
Madam Chair?
Pardon me, Representative Birch.
Yeah, we have, you kind of blew past the Toy Association. I believe I met in the hallway upstairs.
We've addressed that, Representative Birch. I'm going to have them testify, so I'm going to keep going.
Great.
Okay,
thank you.
Jasmine Jemawook, if you could please state your name for the record and give your testimony.
Hi, yeah, I'm here.
Please go ahead.
Hi. My name is Jasmine Jemawook. I am calling in from Anchorage, Alaska. I am a board member for Alaska Community Action on Toxics and a student here at UAA from Elam, Alaska. And I see that this bill protects Alaska's children from the exposure to these flame retardants, which show high concern for children that are exposed. And it's known to have so many health effects, and children in Alaska are disproportionately exposed to flame retardants because of multiple things, and one including like having long winters in Alaska. Mm. The homes have poor ventilation, causing children to come in contact with more dust. And I just believe that keeping flame retardants out of our products is crucial for Alaska's public health. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much. Any questions for the testifier? Okay, seeing none. Now what we're going to do is try to go to the folks that are in the room because we'll have to wrap up in the next 5 or 6 minutes. So Jennifer Gibbons from the Toy Association. If you could please come forward, state your name for the record, and then please present your testimony.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair and members. Jennifer Gibbons with the Toy Association. The Toy Association represents over 950 members of toy retailers and manufacturers in North America. We appreciate this opportunity to express a few concerns with House Bill 27. The toy manufacturers typically do not add flame retardants to toys. However, some of these chemical substances may be found in toys in the internal electronic components, electronic circuit boards, electronic assemblies. These components are inaccessible to children and the flame retardants used in these components are critical to the safety of the products. While there may be alternatives for other uses of flame retardants, in this application, there is no consistent and reliable alternative. Flame retardant bans and electronic components may result in electrical risks that we don't have today. Other states have recognized this and exempted electronics or inaccessible components in flame retardant restrictions. We thank you for your consideration. I'm keeping this brief, but happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, and I apologize because I didn't realize you were in the room and not on the phone, so thank you. I really appreciate that. Any questions for our testifier? Representative Birch.
Well, you know, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Christmas is just around the corner, and I know that's, you know, certainly, you know, big toy. How widespread is this? I guess, I mean, I just don't, I mean, is this like every toy or lots of toys or just the electronic component?
Electronic components of toys would be where a flame retardant ban would be problematic for industry because we do have federal and international flammability standards that must be met. And like I said, it's critical to the safety of the toy that those flame retardants be there.
Thank you. Representative Parrish. Thank you, Representative Birch. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for mentioning the carve-out that some other states have put in place. Has it been the case that all other states which have enacted legislation have had this carve-out?
So there's not necessarily a broad brush. I can only speak to the bills I'm familiar with that relate to children's products because there are states that have enacted flame retardant legislation that would be specific to furniture, and I don't know the specific, or other consumer products, and I don't know the specific specifics of those bills. But with relation to flame retardant restrictions in children or juveniles products, there have been exemptions for consumer electronics or children's electronics or inaccessible components.
Follow up?
Very quickly, please.
So to the best of your knowledge, it hasn't been the case that there's been a restriction on children's products, inaccessible components.
Related to flame retardants?
Yes.
No, not to date.
Okay, thank you. I'd appreciate if you'd share that information, and we'll share that with all the members as well. Thank you so much, and thank you again for being here in person. A few of the folks I think are students here with the Alaska Youth for Environmental Action, so I want to squeeze you in. Olivia Olson, McJune Nobleza, and then Zeb Sheldon. If you could please come forward, maybe all of you, and then we'll do one, two, three. Nice to have some youthful faces testifying today. So whoever wants to go first, if you say your name and affiliation, and then we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Okay. So my name's Olivia Olson. I live in Anchorage, and I'm 16. Thank you, Co-Chair Tarr, and Josephson, and the members of the House.
There we go.
Okay. I'm concerned about flame retardants because it's an everyday product that adults and children are exposed to. I have two younger brothers that I have to worry about. They are constantly touching toys, you know, playing with them. I worry about the health effects this will have on my family. I strongly support this bill because I shouldn't have to worry about this, and I shouldn't have to worry about my family getting cancer, immune disorders, or learning disabilities from these chemicals. Thank you for sponsoring this bill, Representative Tarr, and thanks for taking leadership for a healthier Alaska.
Thank you so much. How about the next person?
Good afternoon. House Resource Committee, Duran Tarr and Anna Josephson. My name is Juno Bleza from Bear, Alaska. I'm 18 and a senior at Bear High School. Sorry, bear with me. My notes are really bad.
You're doing great.
I'm here today to testify for HB 27 concerning the Toxic Free Children Act. Recently, my sister gave birth to one of the cutest babies I'll ever know. And according to my friends, I can never like stop talking about her. I came to testify not just for her, but for my family and other families who are at risk. I didn't come with any statistical facts, research, or data, but I came with the intent to protect not just my cute little niece, but all children who are at risk from these chemicals. This act, I know, will for sure lower the amount of effects majority of consumer products that may have negative effects on us. I strongly advocate for this bill because I care for the young ones and for our future generations. Thank you, Ms. Durantar, for sponsoring this bill.
Thank you. And you're...
Hi, I'm Zebediah Sheldon, and I'm from Palmer, Alaska, and I'm representing myself and my family. And I'm here in support of HB 27, the Toxic Free Children Act. I have a 3-year-old baby sister, and she still runs, plays, and crawls like a baby sister. And these toxic flame-retardant chemicals in her toys and everyday items, she has a higher exposure to these toxics and therefore has a higher likelihood of being harmed by these chemicals, which can lead to cancer and neurological and development delays. And even though these highly toxic flame retardants chemicals do not provide a fire safety benefit, they're still in daily items. And I would like to thank you, Representative Tarr, for sponsoring this bill.
You're welcome. Thank you. And thank you so much for all of you being here today to testify. Does anyone have any questions for these folks? Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to go very quickly to the last few folks in the room. If Pam Miller would please come forward, and then we'll finish up with Sue, and then I'm going to say the name wrong.
It's Jessica.
Jessica, okay, thank you. Sorry, I didn't want to mess it up.
Thank you, Representative Tarr and Representative Josephson, co-chairs and members of the committee, for the opportunity to provide testimony. For the record, my name is Pamela Miller, and I'm an executive director and biologist with Alaska Community Action on Toxics. And we're a statewide environmental health research and advocacy organization of scientists, public health professionals, and community advocates that conducts research and also provides educational programs and training. So we have conducted research in the Norton Sound region, as has been mentioned, and I'll be very glad to provide those scientific studies. My time today is very short, but we've just published a series of papers in the peer-reviewed literature concerning the endocrine disrupting effects of these chemicals, and we have found high levels of these endocrine disrupting flame retardant chemicals in household dust, in the blood serum, and in the traditional foods of people in the northern Bering Sea on St. Lawrence Island. And the levels were of concern and high enough to cause thyroid disruption. So I think one important point to make, and I'd like to counter something that was said by the Toy Industry Association, it's really not true that these flame retardants are not in toys. I participated in an international study of polyvinyl chloride toys, rubber duckies, jump ropes, other types of plastic toys, and many of these toys contain very high levels of flame retardant chemicals because they're made from recycled plastics that are recycled from electronics. I'd also like to say that the entire class of organohalogen flame retardants are associated with a range of adverse health effects. Many of them have been mentioned, but I want to emphasize cancer, neurodevelopmental and reproductive toxicity, and to say again, the developing brain is exceptionally sensitive to injury caused by these toxic chemicals, and learning deficits persist throughout life. And I want to say also that the Consumer Product Safety Commission, as recently as 2017, issued an important warning recommending that manufacturers, importers, and retailers stop selling or using products containing the class of related chemical flame retardants known as organohalogens. These are the ones included in Representative Tarr's bill. And this is because this entire class is associated with adverse health effects. We can't regulate on a chemical-by-chemical basis. These chemicals are very similar at a molecular level. They affect our bodies in a very similar way. So it's very important, I think, to take this class approach because these chemicals do have serious effects. Many states have taken the lead in taking this Consumer Product Safety Commission warning very seriously and are instituting policies, as have been mentioned, taking the lead really in advance of federal rulemaking on this issue. These flame retardants don't break down, so we are finding high levels, as I mentioned, in fish, wildlife, and people of St. Lawrence Island in the northern Bering Sea. So we respectfully ask you to pass this crucial public health measure. HB 27 is receiving strong support from healthcare providers, firefighters, native tribes, and organizations and agencies that serve those people with learning and developmental disabilities. And I think this really needs to be taken seriously. So we thank you today for your testimony and your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Miller. Really appreciate it. Any questions for Ms. Miller? Okay, you're off the hook. So last two here, Sue and then Jessica, if you would please come forward and provide your testimony. And I really appreciate everybody keeping it short when they can. We do, again, I want to make note, have the Juvenile Products Manufacturers Association, American Chemistry Council. I'm not going to close public testimony so that we can invite those folks to testify at a future date. And so that's what we're going to have to do today in the interest of time. So if you could please state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chair Tarr and Josephson and members of the House Resources Committee. My name is Sue Chan, and I am testifying on behalf of myself in support of HB 27. So before I begin, I just want to say I was born and raised in Alaska, and I love this state with all my heart. And I want to know that my home is a safe place to live. When the evidence is clear that flame retardant chemicals are harmful to our health, states have an obligation to protect their citizens when the federal government is slow to act. Alaskans are disproportionately affected by flame retardant chemicals. It's scary to know that Alaska has the highest rate of birth defects in the nation. Even when factoring in alcohol and cigarette use, the numbers cannot be explained. There is something severely wrong, and we need to take a hard look at the root of the issue. 13 states have already adopted policies to rid flame retardant chemicals, and 18 more are looking to adopt additional policies to rid flame retardant chemicals, and Alaska deserves to be as free of chemicals as they are. The name of flame retardants is a misnomer because they don't provide fire safety benefits. They make fires more toxic, which is why firefighters support this bill. The health of Alaskans and Alaskan children deserve to be taken seriously. When Alaskans are pleading for you to protect us, please protect us. Thank you, Representative Garen Tarr, for taking initiative to protect the health of Alaskans by sponsoring HB 27. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. And then please continue.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Garen Tarr, Andy Josephson, and members of this body. My name is Jessica Kim, and I am speaking on behalf of myself and as an individual to support HB 27, the Toxic Free Children Act. HB 27 phases out flame retardant chemicals in everyday products. Flame retardant chemicals do little to prevent fires, yet they are added to everything you use, from the couch you lay on to the computer you use. This means that all of us, including our family, our friends, our grandchildren, anybody, is exposed to highly toxic chemicals that are known to be linked to cancer, hormone disruptions, and neurodevelopmental delays. Major retailers, including IKEA, Walmart, Target, Ashley's Furniture, are already committed to eliminating flame retardants because of the response from consumer demand. We can act now. We can take proactive action on what the federal government won't do to protect our future generation. Thank you to the House Resources Committee and Representative Garen Tarr for sponsoring this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Drummond.
No questions, but thank you for coming to testify to us. And I would appreciate it, and I know the rest of the committee would, to have a copy of your testimony. Thank you. If you'd leave it with the committee aide, that'd be great.
Sure, and we will certainly distribute that to all members. Thank you. Okay, we had a huge lineup. Thank you for the folks that kept it under 2 minutes. Like I said, we had a couple other folks. We're going to leave the public testimony open because I've just pushed it as far as we possibly can on that bill today. So we're going to hold House Bill 27 for future consideration and certainly distribute the many pieces of information that have been requested through the testimony. We're going to go quickly right into – oh, pardon me. Before we go off of that, I'm going to remove my objection to adopting the committee substitute. Is there any other objection? Okay, so we'll have the committee substitute as our working document. Thank you so much, too, Thatcher, for reminding me of that. We're going to go next to House Bill 355, and I'm hoping we'll be able to get through our work on 355 today. Where we left it the other day was that we were considering Amendment Number 1, and I believe, yes, at Representative Rauscher.
At this time, I withdraw Amendment Number 1.
Withdrawing Amendment Number 1. Thank you. That takes us to Amendment Number 2.
At this time, Madam Chair, I withdraw number 2.
Amendment number 2 has been withdrawn. That takes us to amendment number 3.
At this time, I withdraw number three.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Rauscher.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Our language here, amendment number one was actually withdrawn because that had been offered, but two and three had not been offered, so the correct thing is that those are not being offered. So that would take us to amendment number four.
Madam Chair, I do move at this time amendment number four.
Okay, and I'll just object for purposes of discussion.
Madam Chair, this basically, this requires the Alaska Supreme Court to establish a bail schedule. It was put on a few bills already. They need the transition time, and that's basically what this is all about. It can be spoken to by Nancy if you wanted to, but she's not here from the legal department. If you'd like, Daryl can speak more to it if you'd like, but it's a requirement for the adjusted time period that they need for the bail schedule.
Okay.
That's basically the bottom line for this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. I appreciate that. We do have Chris Mache on the line. Would you want him to comment? Mr. Mache, could you please comment? We're on amendment number four.
Yes, hi. For the record, my name is Chris Mache. I'm a director of the Division of Forestry, and we've looked this amendment over, consulted with the Division of Law and Law, also consulted with the court system, and we are in support of this amendment.
Okay, excellent. Any questions for Mr. Mache? Okay, I'm going to remove my objection to adopting amendment number four. Does anyone else have an objection?
Just a question before we consider final adoption. Mr. Mache, Andy Josephson here. Were there any technical or legal issues remaining with amendment four?
Yes. Thank you, Representative Josephson. Yes, there actually is one technical change that could be made. It's on page two of the amendment on line five where it says insert section 25. I believe the renumbering for that section now should read insert section 26.
I don't have page two of this amendment.
I'm going to pass that around. So if everybody has that, we're looking at amendment number four, and there should be a second page to it that just has, it says, basically, it's the renumbering of the sections. And so it looks like there's a typo there where it says insert section 25, where it should say insert section 26.
Right.
Okay. And so...
right at the end of it.
Yes, so I have removed my objection to adopting amendment number four. Representative Josephson, would you like to make that just as a conceptual amendment?
Yes, Madam Kutcher, I move that at page 2, line 5, as a conceptual amendment... that where it says insert section 25, it's instead read insert section 26.
I have no objection.
Okay. Seeing no objection, we will do that, and amendment number four is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. That takes us to amendment number five.
Yes, I would like to move amendment five.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
And to be clear for the record, the amendment is 30-LS1382/D.7.
Representative Josephson, would you like to speak to that amendment?
Yes, and I'd ask Director Mache to speak to it as well, but I think my understanding is that because the penalty could be adjusted and because we're doing a lot of that sort of reform now, through the criminal reform measures, that it's more seamless and cleaner to simply refer to AS 1255.
Mr. Mache, would you like to respond to that?
So, yes, this is Chris Mache, Director of the Division of Forestry. So through the Chair, Representative Josephson, you're correct. Bail schedules currently in state law are up to about a maximum of $500, so that would align. Removal of this amount aligns it with the bail schedules, and then we can adjust the amounts through the misdemeanor or felony charges as appropriate.
Is that okay?
It's okay with me.
Okay. Any further comments or questions for Mr. Mache on this one?
I'll object, Madam Chair. I don't know if anybody objected for the purpose of discussion, but I'm sorry, maybe Mr. Mache could repeat that, because I heard something about $500. But if this is connected to Class A misdemeanor, I'd need a better explanation of where $500 is actually maximum fine. I think a maximum fine on a Class A misdemeanor is more like $25,000. So I'm not exactly sure what that statute, or Representative Josephson maybe can clarify that for me.
Well, I think you're both right, Representative Tallarico. I think it is $25,000 a maximum fine, but I think Director Mache is referring to, how this portion links itself to the bail schedule, which has its own limitations. Is that right, Director Mache?
Yes, that is correct, Representative Josephson. That's the purpose of striking the $5,000, to align it with the bail schedule amounts.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. That answers the question for me. I didn't quite have that connection. Thank you.
Excellent. I think I had made an objection for discussion, and so if I hadn't, and you did.
I'll remove mine.
Okay, and I will remove mine in case we both had. So that means amendment number 5 has been adopted. That brings us to amendment number 6.
Madam Clerk, Madam Chair, at this time we remove the chance to present item 6, amendment 6.
So amendment number 6 is not being offered. That takes us to amendment number 7. And folks might notice this looks a bit like amendment number 1 that we began talking about the other day. And so, Representative Rauscher?
At this time, I'd like to move amendment number 7.
And I'll object for discussion.
This is similar. If you remember in the other one, there was a lot more actually to it. There was some discussion about the... I'm just going to say bugs and other things that could actually be considered as a precursor to the possibility of a fire, where this one basically addresses the basic argument there, which was at any time. Let me just pull my notes out. We got through this so quick. I will be right with you. The amendment addresses and preserves public property rights when forestry officials can enter onto private property. By deleting any time on page 2, line 12, and inserting when responding to wildland fire or suspected fire or administering the provisions of this chapter, I believe, does away with the need for any time unless it's firing a wildland fire, investigating the reason for that, and looking at other properties that could be affected at that time. But it preserves homeowners' rights to their property to be notified before they enter for other things. And that's all it basically does. It gives them the same rights they have right now. It doesn't take anything away from them. It just, at any time for those type of things, is not really a necessity. They still have time to contact the homeowner through other methods, which they use now or can use in the future. And that's basically it. Keeps that in there in this response to the wildland fire and suspected fire administering previous in this chapter. So I think this, for me, it solves the problem. I'm hoping it does for everybody else. So.
Okay. Director Mache, could you comment about the, support for this particular amendment you had for the earlier ones?
Yes, for the record, this is Director Chris Mache. And, Madam Chair, yes, we've looked this over carefully and have discussed this with the Department of Law, and we can support the amendment as proposed.
Okay, thank you. Representative Parrish, did you have a question?
Just a comment, actually, on this one. This whole section is one big, long, terrible sentence. And it's going to get a little bit longer and more terrible with this. It all starts with upon approval by the commissioner or an authorized agent. So I certainly hope that they're not doing those things frivolously. But I'll defer to the will of the department.
And Representative Parrish, this bill does have another committee of referral. And so perhaps that can be you know, an additional issue to pursue. I'm going to remove my objection to this amendment. Is there any other objection to this amendment? Okay, seeing no objection, then amendment number 7 has been adopted. That completes the amendments we had for consideration, and that brings House Bill 355 back before the committee for discussion. Is there any other discussion on House Bill 355? Representative Rauscher.
I thank you for the opportunity to just make a quick statement. There was a peace officer thing I wanted to address, which I will address in another committee, but I do appreciate the expediency here, and for the sake of expediency, I appreciate the time that you allowed me. Thank you.
Excellent. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to put on the record one more time, the definition of forested land is not what you would guess. It's, what is it, any land supporting burnable materials, natural burnable materials in their native state, something like that. It covers everything from a forest to, you know, a little bit of scrub to even lichen. It's a remarkable definition, but not one that I want to sidetrack the committee on any further.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. Appreciate that. If there's no further discussion on this bill, then I would entertain a motion.
Madam Co-Chair, I move House Bill 355, version 30S1382/D, as amended, with accompanying fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Seeing and hearing no objection, House Bill 355 will move from committee. And because we're working in record speed this afternoon, and really, really want to say thank you to Mr. Bisson, if you could please come forward. We're going to continue on because we want to at least get an introduction to this particular piece of legislation, House Bill 330. It is the first hearing today. We might run over by a moment or two, and if you can stay, please do. But this is the first hearing, so we were just planning to introduce the bill today, and we have some additional folks online, Becky Cruz from the Division of Oil and Gas, Martin Schultz from Department of Law, and Jim Beckham, Deputy Director of Division of Oil and Gas. Mr. Bisson, please go forward. Go ahead.
Thank you, everybody, for having me here today, and so I can, you guys can hear this. Here to talk about House Bill 330, which is about protective orders. My name is Tim Bisson. I work as an audit manager for the Division of Oil and Gas and in the Department of Natural Resources. Did I do this? All right. I work with a team of 9 auditors. We audit state royalties and net profit share payments. We audit federal royalties, all for revenue for the state of Alaska. Since FY03, we've conducted 91 audits, collected over $270 million, and some of our common issues, audit issues, are marine transportation deductions, pipeline deductions. Thank you. Starting value and higher of calculation, and I'll higher of calculation is why House Bill 330 is being proposed. So when we compute royalties, our leases say the royalty rate, which is a minimum by statute of 12.5%, it goes up, can go up higher, and the method of calculating the royalty payments. All of the leases have a clause that talk about value, and it all of them, the clause all say that it needs to be done with sales of the other producers. The state is owed royalties based on the highest of 3 items normally in general, the lessee's field price, the posted price, or an average of other producers' prices, field prices. So in order to come up with the average of the other producers' field prices, we have to use their confidential sales information. So this comes to why, or some reasons why House Bill 330 would be very helpful. Royalty audit section, as I just said, we use confidential price information from other producers. Its lease provisions say that all the producers must submit their sales contracts, invoices, that kind, and other data to us to verify it for accounting and audit purposes. When we finish our audit, we issue it. If it has a higher up claim, we'll issue it, and then an audited lessee will naturally ask to see what backs up, what supports our audit. And so oftentimes that'll have the will have used the confidential sales data. So we offer then we will so that I'll refer to them as the audited lessee, and going forward the other producers will be I'll call them the disclosing lessee because it's their information we're disclosing. So we'll talk to the disclosing lessee and ask them if we can disclose their information, usually using a confidentiality agreement, to the audited lessee. And oftentimes we hear objections. Currently we don't have a really great way forward from there, and House Bill 330 would be a good solution. We feel it's a good solution. To give it a frame of reference, we currently have 7 royalty audits in appeal that with higher of claims of roughly $39 million under appeal. And those will be growing as we continue with more audits. The solution is a protective order to be issued by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. So this slide's just to talk about protective orders quickly. The common tool is used by the courts, other agencies, including administration and the Department of Revenue. Department of Revenue for oil and gas tax production purposes has a similar right to issue protective orders for similar lessees. A protective order limits access to who can view the information, who can see it, its use. For these protective orders, I would say it's limited to resolution of this audit with the distribution, so it can't get spread out to everybody in the companies, just narrowly scoped for those who would be working on the resolution. And at the end, the information has to be sent back or it's destroyed, so disposition at the end. Under House Bill 330, the commissioner would determine that disclosure is needed, so we have an audited lessee who wants to see what backs up our higher of claim. We would give notice to the disclosing lessee saying this is what we intend to disclose, an opportunity to be heard about, so they could file objections, we could work through those, and then the commissioner can issue the protective order with the limits described just above. In the previous committee, the House Judiciary, they had 2 amendments. Amendment number 1 limited the applicability. The initial bill was for the whole department, so it narrowed the scope from the whole department to oil and gas issues. It also clarified what the word lease in there, that it wasn't modifying the words appeal or request for consideration. This, as you'll see in Amendment 2, became moot. And then it added the term net profit shares in there. To ensure that those are captured, because there are also other audits that we do. And then amendment number 2 narrowed the scope to royalty audits only. Previously, it could have been used, the powers could have been used for geological or geophysical data as well. And then the last slide is the sectional that says it's a new provision giving the Commissioner of Natural Resources the duties and power to determine whether disclosure is necessary. If it is necessary, then notice an opportunity to be heard by the disclosing lessees, and allows the commissioner to issue the protective order with the limits that I mentioned earlier. And then section 2 is conforming language to a statute that it relates to our cost information and financial information that would be used in our audits. And Section 3 is conforming language to statute dealing with the punishments for divulging confidential information that if we get information in audits, that we divulge it. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Let's take a couple questions, and then we have one person signed up to testify. Representative Birch.
Thank you. Thank you for the briefing. Through the chair, how does it work when you do royalty in kind? Because as I understand it, the state reserves an option to say, hey, I want my barrels of oil as opposed to a check. And how does that transition happen or get calculated in this effort?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, this only applies to royalty and value barrels. So the royalty and kind is totally separate. So we have the contracts for that, and that takes care of that. And then this is for the barrels that we get in value.
So it's actually a different arrangement depending mm-hmm. on the location and contract and producer?
Yeah. So the royalty and kind contract, we have to do nominations that will take those barrels, and everything that's left over outside of the royalty and contract, we take in value, and then the companies go and sell it, and then pay us the royalty sometimes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm looking at the page. It says YHB 330. It's the fourth bullet. It's sort of the one that strikes me as the key point. I guess what I'm trying to gather here is when you say the other producers haven't voluntarily allowed the sharing of confidential price information, it begs a bunch of questions. Can they be compelled to do it? Or is this bill about assuaging their concerns with proprietary information so that everyone sort of agrees by consent to do it? I'm just trying to get a sense of what's going on in that fourth bullet.
To the Chair, Representative Josephson, the solutions we currently have in would mean taking things to a court to get a protective order there, and we don't want to do that because it takes up the court's time, our time, and the company's time. That's the probably the best solution we have right now to do that, and we would it would be preferred to do a method like this.
A follow-up real fast. So, Mr. Bisson, so is it is everyone sort of on the same page here? Is it your belief that if we pass this bill, then all will be well, and there will be more disclosure of information that people are comfortable with? I mean, do you have sort of prearranged agreement as to the language?
Through the chairs, are you asking about the language of what the protective orders would look like?
Yeah.
We have used some confidentiality agreements in the past and have some language that's been used through those that have been acceptable for companies.
Right. Thank you.
Representative Parrish had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of the $39.2 million in pending audits, are any of them concerned with geologic or geophysical data? Is there much money there?
Through the chair, no. We don't use geological and geophysical data for our higher of claims. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we resolve this issue by passing this bill, does the state realize more of revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, it creates an opportunity to resolve our audits, which will, I believe, I can't answer because there would be other issues that go along with it, so I don't want to say something that might not be true.
Okay. All right.
But it will remove a hurdle that we currently have to resolve our audits.
Yeah, follow-up, Madam Chair?
Sure.
Yeah, and I know it is an issue to resolve audits and get them done as quickly as possible, so this bill will help that happen.
We are hoping so, yes.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our outstanding royalty monies, do they collect interest?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
Yeah, by statute.
Thanks.
Any other questions for Mr. Bisson? Is that right? Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Okay, seeing none, we had advertises for public testimony. We do have one person, Ms. Moriarty from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. If you're online and could please provide your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Tara Moriarty, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. So Co-Chair Josephson and Co-Chair Tarr and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present our concerns with this bill. As you know, AOGA is a private trade association that represents the majority of oil and gas producers, explorers, refiners, and transporters of oil and gas. And my brief comments today reflect the views of our membership. And AOGA recognizes the administration's efforts to address the potential issues surrounding royalty audits and appeals, and we recognize that. But unfortunately, we do not support the bill in its current form, and we have conveyed the two concerns I'm going to outline to you very briefly. We have conveyed these concerns to DNR. So the two concerns we have, the first one, we have two concerns, both of which, if addressed, would provide further clarity for the while also preserving the administration's intent as expressed in the transmittal letter and by the presentation that you just heard. First, we believe that House Bill 330 should add language that exempts royalty settlement agreements from being included as part of these efforts. And the reason we think that is that these agreements are contractual between the state and a company, and they vary based on the terms of that specific agreement. And so royalty settlement agreements often contain other certain legal restrictions regarding the disclosure of confidential information to a party not part of the contractual agreement. So we just think that if we could exempt a royalty settlement agreement, it would not interfere with what DNR is trying to achieve. Our second concern is in regard to which individuals from the parties involved under the protective order would have access to the confidential information during a royalty audit or appeal. And we just feel that House Bill 330 should limit the release of confidential information to only those individuals who are directly involved with the royalty audit or appeal, and not those individuals who may work outside of such matters. So we just think the language should be tightened up to really limit the release of the confidential information during these types of audits or appeals to those people who are actually working on the protective order. So we, as I mentioned, we've communicated these concerns with DNR, and we've kept an open dialogue with the agency since they introduced this legislation, and until these two concerns are addressed, we can't support this current version, but we do look forward to continue to work either with your committee and or with DNR to try to find resolutions to these two issues. So with that, we just wanted to get that on the record, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Representative Josephson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Moriarty, did you bring these concerns before the House Judiciary Committee?
Representative Josephson, through the co-chair, no, we did not, because the House Judiciary schedule happened pretty quickly, okay. And our member companies had not fully analyzed the bill by the time public testimony was scheduled in House Judiciary. So, unfortunately, we did not have an opportunity to share our concerns with that committee until after it had moved out.
All right. And I want to say that I understand that those things happen.
We are about out of time here because the next committee is going to come in. Mr. Bassan, do you have a brief comment in response to those suggestions at this time? Okay. What we had hoped to do with this bill is have amendments due Monday by 10 a.m. so that we could bring that back up. What I will commit to doing is following up on the AOGA suggestions here, and anyone else, please do as well, and we'll try to see if there are remedies to those that we can come up with a language for and get something for consideration. So if members could please have amendments due by 10 a.m. on Monday so we can bring this back up, then that would be very helpful. And just in our closing moments here, I guess I don't have the list for next week, so I'm not going to say it. So just amendments due at 10 a.m. on Monday. Thank you so much to everyone for sticking around for these next extra 11 minutes so we could get through a very busy schedule today. And everyone have a wonderful weekend. We're adjourned.